get a sense of how the private sector was potentially an engine for, you know, growth and development. That time, India, it was all about development, all about economic development.
Welcome to the Indianness podcast. We bring you inspiring stories from leaders with Indian roots across business, healthcare, education, politics, and more. Hear how they broke barriers and are shaping the future one bold step at a time. Bhaskar Chakravarti doesn't just study global change, he measures it. As the force behind Digital Planet and Dean of Global Business at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, he tracks how technology reshapes economies and societies. Economist, strategist, author, and trusted advisor to Fortune 500 leaders, he brings data, depth, and a distinctly global perspective to every conversation.
Welcome, Bhaskar. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's a privilege to be here. Great to chat with you.
So let's begin with your journey. You had one of the most fascinatingly non-linear careers that I've ever come across, from Tata Group to Bell Labs, from Game Theory to McKinsey, from Harvard to Tufts. You know, take us through the arc of the journey, but start from the where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your parents, and a little bit about the household culture. What was that like?
Great. Well, thank you, Sanjay. And I'll take the opportunity to actually reflect on some of these questions, which I don't think I've had much time to think about. So in many ways, you know, we'll explore my own journey together. You know, most of us are, you know, caught up in the day-to-day so much that, you know, you often forget the yesterdays. And, you know, Shakespeare famously said, "And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death." And sometimes I wonder whether we should be, you know, spending a little bit more time reflecting on our yesterday. So to answer your question, where was I born? I was born in a place called Willingdon Hospital in New Delhi, and which is, I think it's called something else now, but it still stands. And my last name, those who are from India will probably recognize, suggests that I'm from the eastern part of the country. My family is from Bengal. Both my parents were born and grew up in what is currently Bangladesh. And prior to partition, my parents, you know, got married and they, you know, moved to Calcutta, and then from Calcutta they moved to Delhi. And I'm a Delhi boy. I'm you know, displaced many times over. So that's kind of the beginning of my journey. And you know, my father was he was an academic. He was in policy. And then eventually became a bureaucrat. And we moved from, you know, kind of the bureaucratic heart of Delhi to what one might most kindly describe as the Bengali ghetto of Delhi. So I, you know, a big chunk of my childhood was in Chittaranjan Park in Delhi. And yeah, so that's kind of the beginning. And just one little note, I mentioned, I was born in Willingdon Hospital in Delhi. And 19 days later, in the same hospital, down the same corridor, was born another wonderful person, probably far more wonderful than I can ever hope to be. That's my wife. And so we you know, started in a very similar location. And, you know, here we are in all the way in Boston many, 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 many years later.
What was the family culture like? You know, what kind of brought you, as I said, you have such an incredible non-linear career. So I'm just trying to figure out where it all came from.
My father's side and my mother's side, you know, a bit of a different story. My father's family has a really interesting past in the sense that the entire family, there's my father's siblings, they were all on the front lines of the freedom movement. And so the deal was, he was the youngest of four brothers. And the deal was that he was the one who was going to stay out of jail. And he would earn enough money to pay for the families of, you know, all the siblings. So, you know, back then, I think there were two sources of income that could not guarantee, but at least provide some threshold of stability. One is that you become a professor, and the other is you become a civil servant. So he took the civil service exam. He got admitted to the civil service. And then the government found out, and this was pre-independence, the government found out that two of his brothers were in jail, and they rescinded his offer. So there goes the steady income from civil service. And then he became a humble professor at Calcutta University. But as I said, there was basically those two. And then, you know, you could be a doctor or a scientist, but that, you know, his training was actually in economics. So he couldn't be either a doctor or at least a scientist of the kind of the old fashioned variety. And, my father, in many ways, is the most the significant influence on my life. He was kind of a Renaissance man who, you know, came out of the coconut groves of the Bengali Delta. He literally swam rivers to, you know, get to school because, the little town he grew up in was surrounded by various tributaries of the rivers around there. And those rivers would flood all the time. So we hear these apocryphal stories of, our earlier generations, swimming rivers to get to school. He actually did that. The other thing about my father was that he had a photographic memory, and his memory, dated back to when he was probably like 3 years old. And he was always a teller of stories. So I grew up with, this vivid pictures of his growing up, in present day Bangladesh, to the times of partition, to, what was happening during the freedom movement. And I can keep going. So I think I feel my own history dates way before Willingdon Hospital, because I have such, I almost feel like I had been there because of my father's, ability to just recall the most minute details. And I know that he wasn't making this stuff up. He was very good at this. And to some extent, as I grew up and became an adolescent and became my own person, I started getting annoyed, with him, because he would keep going back, 40 years back into the past. And I'd kind of say, okay, enough of this. Let's kind of move forward. I was interested in the Rolling Stones, and, he had no idea what the Rolling Stones were. Anyway, so that's kind of part of the story. And then as I started developing my own memories, I still remember. One of my earliest memories was my father waking up in the morning, and there were tears streaming down his face. And he said, come with me. And he put me on his shoulder, and we walked from where we lived in South Delhi to the center of Delhi, Rajpath. And as we were walking, I realized that something really big had happened, which is Jawaharlal Nehru had died. And I still remember sitting on my father's shoulders. There was a huge crowd in Rajpath, in the center of Delhi, and Nehru's body was going down Rajpath. That was one of my earliest memories, and just tears streaming down my father's face. And in many ways, I think that vision also combines a few different things about my upbringing, which is, my father, apart from being an oral historian, he was also an intellectual, of the true, kind of Bengali kind. He was, he was immersed in Tagore. We would have, Tagore songs playing, all the time. He would recite poetry, and then he would make me translate that into English, because he used to say that the translation of Tagore into English is so terrible that we need to redo it. So a large part of my even learning Bengali, had to do with translating Tagore into English, and also that's how I learned English simultaneously. So I think all of these elements sort of came together, and in many ways Nehru was an embodiment of the kind of intellectual Fabian socialist that my father was, and so that was the environment in which I grew up. On my mother's side, it was a somewhat of a different story. My mother was a very strict disciplinarian, and she was pretty much the one who made sure that I did my homework and kept up with my grades in school. And, but over the course of the arc of life, I feel extremely fortunate that I had them as parents. And I have one sibling who was 11 and a half years older than I am. So we were like two two generations, within one family, and of course, growing up in Delhi is kind of a completely new set of experience. I think I absorbed a lot from my parents while I was young. By the time I became an adolescent and started growing older, I started separating from them, and most of my influences were outside the home, and in many ways, almost kind of rejecting, what was in the home. Not that there was anything bad about it. It's just that you kind of go through the process of saying, okay, I'm not going to look inward or backwards. I want to look outward.
Not want to look inwards, but want to look outward. What made you get into St. Stephen's?
I grew up in a time in India where, you had a handful of choices. And by a handful, I don't mean all five fingers, less than five fingers are choices when you graduate from high school. And so I took my high school leaving exam in December, which is, I took what used to be called the ISC exam. So you leave in December and then, you start college in July or August. And then you have, choices to make in terms of, some entrance exams to take. And then, of course, you join colleges. I enrolled in kind of the classes to study for the IIT exam because I didn't know what else to do. And, we had like four or five months to kill time. So I enrolled in those classes. I realized initially I had thought that I would do medicine. Then I talked to a bunch of people who were doctors and they said, don't do medicine. And I said, okay, fine. They probably know what they're talking about. And I literally just attended the IIT classes because all my friends were, taking these classes. And I, as they say, bunked most of the classes and used to go and watch matinees during some essential classes and walked out after the first part of the IIT exam. And ultimately, I realized that I really had no interest in doing engineering. Inherently, my interest was, coming back to the influence of my father, very much in the social sciences and thinking about, the combination of these different, humanistic influences on life. And the only other path in those days used to be, okay, you take a particular direction in order to take the civil service exam. So back then, again, joining the IAS or the IFS or, any of the UPSC directions was the other path, right? So I enrolled in St. Stephen's College in economics. And sometimes I look back and say, wow, I mean, this was a pretty selective process, obviously, you needed to have the marks to get in, but it was a very, very small group. There was, we had two sections. I think we were less than 70 students. And the number of applicants is mind-boggling. When I do the percentage in terms of the people who get in, it's ridiculously small. So I feel very fortunate in kind of having gone through that narrow bottleneck. But beyond the bottleneck, the most interesting aspect, and again, shaping my own life journey, are the people I met on the other side of the bottleneck, and they, of course, defined so much of my own mindset as I went beyond that.
So you're talking about Stephen. So a lot of leaders have come out, global leaders have come out, as from Stephen's, just like you. What was that experience like? What was that experience at Stephen's? Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think when I look back at those times, most of us, many of us, think of our college days as some of the most wonderful times in our lives because, there was a degree of carefreeness and a degree of innocence. And of course, you were anxious about, all kinds of things, but there was this element of youthful ignorance of the world around you in many ways, but at the same time, kind of immersing in certain things that you felt passionate about. And I must say, now having kind of lived the arc of my own life, and then subsequently my children's lives, and then looking at the arcs of so many other people's journeys, and then also reflecting on my parents' journey during a very difficult time, partition and so on. I feel enormously fortunate in having been you know, not just at St. Stephen's, but having been of a generation that almost kind of went through this golden age. Because I went to St. Stephen's College at a time when, you know, St. Stephen's was already a very distinguished, established institution. You know, institutions like the IITs were relatively newer, and they were coming up, and they, you know, were tremendous places to go to. Many of the medical schools were tremendous places to go to. Now, a lot of that was a gift of the post-independence era. I was a generation that did not have to, you know, face the trauma of partition and independence, didn't have to go through the teething process of these institutions coming of age, went to schools like St. Stephen's College and Delhi School of Economics, which were modeled on long, you know, kind of held traditions, you know, from the medieval ages, you know, from England. And I literally felt that we arrived at a time when the underlying infrastructure was just right to provide us probably the best education I can imagine. And I'm saying this after having seen the education that my own children have gone through here in the United States. They've gone to the best schools I can, you know, imaginable. And even with that exposure, I can stand next to them and say, you know what, my education coming from a poor, back then it was okay to call India a third world country. You know, my education was no weaker than yours, and in many ways stronger than yours. And those times were absolutely wonderful. You know, I can rattle off names that, you know, your viewers will recognize. You know, I sat on the editorial board of Cooler Talk, of which is the college rag in St. Stephen's, with Ram Guha, who's now an eminent historian, and India's most preeminent historian, or with Arvind Subramaniam, who was chief advisor to the Modi administration, and now kind of a general guru on the global economy in India, Ivan Menezes, who sadly passed away, and CEO of Diageo, Ajay Banga, you know, very good friend over the years, now president of the World Bank. You know, we were, Rukmini Banerjee, who was CEO of Pratham, the largest education NGO in the world. I can keep going. You know, Piyush Gupta, who was CEO of DBS, and I'm just rattling off names of people that your listeners might recognize. But beyond these quote unquote famous names, we just had these wonderful friendships of people who just did amazing things. You know, both while they were in college, and you could see what they would be doing down the road. I mean, think of Aditya Arya, who, you know, has opened a museum of photography in Delhi. A lot of people may not know the name, but, you know, he's just an iconic figure in the world of photography. You know, an art that is now lost because each one of us, you know, carries this thing in our pocket. So I think I personally felt that you're right. I think there's a selection process, and beyond that, you know, you put a bunch of people together who have gone through a very narrow bottleneck, and they bring their interests, their fascination, you know, the fascinating talents, and a certain degree of weirdness to the conversation, and it was literally conversations that would happen, you know, late in the night or early in the morning. And I just, you know, there's so many personalities that I can speak about that we could take up several hours of your podcast. But I feel extremely fortunate to have been, you know, part of at least, you know, in sometimes, you know, just there to absorb from them, and I learned so much from them.
Do you think going to Stephen's was an inflection point in your life?
Oh, without question. It was an inflection point in my life for many, many reasons, not the least of which being, I started developing, you know, my own mind, in many ways, a mind separate from that of my father's, who was kind of the defining personality, even though I was mentally trying to separate from him. But then going to college was kind of a true separation. That was a defining moment. But the most significant inflection point for me was my now wife and I, we joined St. Stephen's College at the same time.
At that time, did you know her when you joined the college?
So in that period between finishing high school and starting college, as I mentioned, I was bunking the IIT entrance, those mugging shops, and going to a matinees. I was going to a matinee with her. And she was taking French classes down the road. We're in the same time frame, same thing. So that has been life changing, because in so many ways we've grown up together, and our journeys have sort of kind of been interwoven, and so much of my both my personal and intellectual life has been shaped by her. So in college has been St. Stephen's College has been an inflection point for many, many reasons. The fact that my wife and I, we actually started, going together, going out together, there, our lives were, shaped there. We met our friends there. And then, of course, things went in all kinds of interesting directions. And I think, obviously, there's not one inflection. There are, many, many inflections. But I do think of the time we spent in not just kind of debating and arguing over, over important, seemingly important things, but also doing really silly things. And I miss that silliness as we kind of get older and people start getting more serious. And these days, when I meet many of our college friends, I look for the glimmers of that silliness, and it's great that many of them still retain it, and they haven't all become sort of old farts basically.
So once you graduated from Stephens, tell our listeners where was the arc, and then we want to talk a little more about the other inflection points too.
Yeah, so in keeping with the notion that I went to school at a time when there was this somewhat of a golden age post-partition, all these institutions that had been established with models to draw upon. So St. Stephen's College was modeled on Cambridge, and Delhi School of Economics was modeled on the London School of Economics. And wanted to do economics like my father, and I went to the Delhi School of Economics, and there again, I think much of our time was spent debating and discussing issues either in the area of economics or in the area of cricket. And much of that conversation used to happen outside the lecture halls, the very famous cafe in Delhi School. And again, met many friends, several of whom had come over from St. Stephen's, and then many new friends, in Delhi School, and that's where I started developing an interest in the economics as a profession, in terms of an academic direction, and because the Delhi School has this incredible legacy of people from like Amartya Sen and Kaushik Basu was actually my professor, Jagdish Bhagwati, Sukumar Chakravarti. I mean, these are legends in kind of the economics pantheon. And, they were at the faculty. Then some of them had been at the faculty in Delhi School. So it became almost a natural thing, which is that you are going to, you're going to do economics as an academic. When I was in my final year in Delhi School, and of course, at that point, you wanted to kind of figure out what next. Everybody at that point who was interested in doing academics was thinking about applying abroad. And I came from a middle class family with literally not much money to pay for an education. So you apply to as many different institutions as you can in the US, primarily because they were the ones that offered scholarships, and I only applied to the ones that gave me the admission fee waiver, because I couldn't afford whatever it was, $15 that you had to pay to fill out an application. So sent out applications, and then my wife, who was also applying, and she was a bit of a reluctant applicant. She was, not terribly interested in following an academic path, but we were, trying to, at that time we weren't married, but we were trying to sort of align our journeys from thereon. And, you know, we jointly applied to places, and we tried to find a home in universities that were close enough and were offering us a full scholarship so that, you know, everything would be paid for. As we were doing that, I thought I would also apply to the Tata Administrative Service, which at that time was, you know, kind of the Tata Group is now, of course, a big preeminent conglomerate. Back then, it was probably the only preeminent conglomerate in India. And the Tata Administrative Service seemed like an sort of an interesting opportunity to check out the private sector, the corporate sector. And I went through, I can't remember how many rounds of interviews and tests and so on. It was quite a, you know, a long process. And frankly, I didn't even know what to expect in those, you know, interviews and various screenings, and somehow, you know, made it on the other side. And then had a fascinating summer where, you know, I was exposed to many different companies across the Tata Group, which at that time, you know, this was not in India that was chock-a-block with lots of industry, but this was this one place where you could see the range of the beginnings, you know, the green shoots of Indian growth, particularly in the private sector coming up. You know, the Taj Hotels were coming up, of course, Tata Steel and electricity and Tata Power. And, you know, all of that was, you know, some of them were further along than others, but it's just fascinating, an exposure to this wide range of Indian industry. And then, you know, also meeting with, you know, several members of the Tata Pantheon. It was quite inspiring to get a sense of how the private sector was potentially an engine for, you know, growth and development. That time, India, it was all about development, all about economic development. And we never thought of, you know, particularly coming from the Delhi School, coming from an economics background, you thought about government and policy and the Planning Commission as being the foundation for development. And this was, I thought of just a fascinating exposure to seeing a really a sincerely committed, honest conglomerate, you know, eager to be a part of India's growth. And I carried that, you know, in my head, which is I kind of said, you know, it's really important to consider policy and profits as potentially partners in development. And then that sort of played a role in my thinking down the road.
And I think you touched upon something where, you know, a lot of our viewers would not know that Tata's ethos of nation building is very, very important. Did you get a sense of that? And you say that carries forward for you.
Even in that short period, as I mentioned, you know, back then, you know, Ratan Tata was not, you know, what he became. But I remember, you know, sitting with him and, you know, him explaining, you know, how he saw the role of the group and, you know, his own inspiration, you know, from earlier generations, and how the story of India's growth was intertwined with the story of the growth of the Tata Group. And I just found that, you know, just that journey and his vision at that point, and several others who were kind of part of the, you know, part of the upper echelons of Tata, because, you know, when you join TAS, you join a really small select core of people, and you're given access to, you know, all these, the muckety-mucks of the organization. So I thought it was an incredible privilege to, you know, hear from essentially the captains of industry at that point. And their story was not about the company. Their story was about India. And I felt that they were being sincere in telling that story. They really, it really came across, you know, when they spoke about it. Another thing that struck me was I came from Delhi and I was working in Bombay. I was struck by the fact that Bombay or Mumbai had electricity for 24 hours a day. And I said, this is amazing. I, you know, because in Delhi, I wasn't used to that. You know, we had power blackouts, you know, quite frequently. And so what's the difference? And the difference was the electricity from Bombay was coming from the Tata Power Group. And I thought this is interesting, you know, that they were far more efficient in supplying power to a bigger city You know, I think Bombay at that time was larger than Delhi, with a lot more demand in terms of electricity because of the nature of, you know, what Bombay is. And it left a deep impression in my mind. And similarly, water, you know, more reliable in Bombay than it was in Delhi. And again, the role of the, you know, of the private sector in growth and development, I could see it, you know, in many different ways. And I think that left a deep impression in my mind. And in many ways, I think that sort of separated me from the way a lot of Delhi school economists sort of grow up, because you think about policy as being the, you know, the primary instrument, if not the battering ram, that you use to open the door of growth and development. And I realized that policy is only, you know, one instrument, but you need a few others.
The role of a company is to increase shareholder value, right? And then we're talking about nation building. Is there some convergence there in your view?
Particularly if you are a company in a developing market where a large part of your consumer base is also developing. So in order to put money in the pockets of your consumers so that they can afford your products, you need to figure out how you know, the nation building, the nation development journey aligns with your profit development and profit building journey. Because if you don't, you won't have a market. And so I think that's a lesson that, you know, many developing world companies have absorbed and realized. And it's almost second nature for them. You don't need to, you know, have classes in corporate social responsibility or shared value or fancy frameworks. That's just the way business gets done. And and of course, it's in the pursuit of profit, because in the absence of profit, there isn't going to be the resources to keep the company going. But I also do believe a degree of commitment and sincerity matters. And what I saw with the Tata Group, and I actually ended up doing some work with the Tata Group down the road. After, you know, many years later, I'd sort of come back and I had done some work with Tata Motors. And I saw, and this was many, many years later, and this was India at a very different stage. And Tata Motors at that time had already purchased Jaguar and Land Rover. So it was a very different stage of both the company and the country. And when I sat down with Ratan Tata at that time, and I saw the same sincerity in the man. And so I felt that that a sense of a joint responsibility is important. And in many ways, it steers, you know, your priorities as a company. You can make profits in a number of different ways, but it's possible to align these elements in certain contexts.